Thanks for listening to Exploring the Wine Glass podcast, the podcast for people who love wine. I'm Lori Budd, a UC Davis winemaking program and WSET Level 2 graduate. You can find Exploring the Wine Glass on all the socials, as well as your favorite podcast catchers. If you haven't subscribed yet, now's the perfect time. I promise I'll never tell you what to drink, but I'll always share what's in my glass. Hey everyone, thanks for listening to Exploring the Wine Glass. When I went through the WSET Level 2 class, at no point was Turkish wine ever brought into the conversation. Quite some time ago, I came across a person on Twitter that I decided to follow because she was always talking about Turkish wine. Through each post, her enthusiasm and passion for the wine showed, and everyone who knows me knows that I love to share someone's passion for wine. Andrea Lemieux, aka the Corky Cork, began enjoying wine while she lived in Washington, D.C., but it wasn't until she moved to Turkey for a job that she fell in love with it. Join us as she tells me about the long history of winemaking in Turkey, teaches me about pronouncing those difficult to pronounce Turkish wine grapes, and why we can't find these wines in the United States. She also will provide tips on the best places to visit on your next trip to Turkey. If you enjoy this podcast, please take a time to rate, review, and subscribe. iTunes suggests podcasts based on these star reviews, and each new review can help other wine lovers find our podcast. Sláinte! Hey everybody, welcome to Allure of the Poor. I am your host, Lori Budd. I am a UC Davis winemaking graduate and a WSET Level 2 graduate. And today I am so excited. I mean, like, so to infinity excited, because, you know, social media is really makes the world a smaller place. And my guest today, we have been chatting on Twitter for a very, very long time, and I adore reading her writings, and just recently she started doing these cool animated videos of the wine tastings, and I absolutely love them, and I get so excited when I see them as I'm scrolling through Twitter, and I see them, and I have to blow them up on so that I can see what they are. But today, my guest is Andrea Lemieux, and she is like the Turkish wine guru. Like, she talks about grapes that I have never ever heard of before, and every time she talks about it, I want to run out and try to find some. So, Andrea, welcome, welcome, welcome.
Thank you so much. I am so beyond thrilled to be here. Well, I mean, here, Istanbul here, but virtually here with you.
virtually here. And I thank you. It's really early in the morning or late at night, however you want to look at it, for you. So I appreciate you taking the time to share your expertise with my listeners, because this is very different than any other podcast that I have ever done, because, you know, these are grape varieties that just aren't in the common, you know, household here, you know, and you have such a passion. So, you know, me and my passion for wine, you know, it's just so exciting. But I did see you take a sip. So what are you drinking? What are you drinking?
Yeah, it's 1:30 in the morning, so I, you know, let myself over the bottle.
There you go.
I am drinking, actually, I've got the bottle right here. I am drinking one of our best sparkling wines. This is called Yashasin. It's from one of our producers, Vinkara, which I know is available in the United States. I did check.
Okay.
So this is available from a few retailers in the U.S., I think possibly even online. And it's a Blanc de Noir, a traditional method sparkling wine made from the grape Kalajic Karasa.
One more time?
It's called Kalajic Karasa.
Kalajic Karasa. Close enough?
Exactly.
Close enough.
It's all good.
Close enough. Well, I too am sipping, and we do, as you know, I have wine for Bed Street after this, and Debbie and I have made a pact that we don't drink the wine prior. So it is a Dornfelder, and I am a little bit nervous because I didn't realize I picked up a sweet one. So, yeah.
I didn't know they made sweet ones.
Neither did I. Neither did I. So I think I've only had one Dornfelder ever before. And now this is going to be a sweet one. So I am drinking Cab Franc.
It's a good grape.
You know, I don't know. I've heard of this one before. I've heard of this one before. This is actually from Derby Estates, from Paso Robles. So, you know, I love to support local. And Derby is one of my favorite wineries in Paso. I do frequent them on a regular basis. So virtually, I raise a glass with you, Slancha. And cheers.
Afiyet olsun, as we say in Turkey.
All right. See, I'm learning so much already. All right. So before we get into the wines of Turkey, we got to get into a little bit about you. So, you know, how and when did you get into wine?
Oh, gosh. So I was a wine drinker when I lived in the U.S. I lived for quite a long time in D.C., so we had access to all of the, you know, the Virginia and the Maryland wineries. But I think beyond whether or not I liked the wine, I didn't think much more about it. And then I moved to Turkey about 7 years ago, actually 7 years next week.
Oh, happy anniversary.
And we don't get a lot of wine in the way of imported wine, certainly not quality imported wine. So I started drinking Turkish wine somewhat out of necessity, and somewhere along the way kind of had this, what the heck is this grape kind of moment, and started just reading about wine, and then I read some more about it, and then I started looking up wine blogs and, you know, visiting wineries here, and it just, I don't know, it just kind of happened. I just kind of fell into it. And a few years ago, I was in Italy on a food tour, and the tour guide was telling us that she was a certified sommelier. Had done her studying in both Italy and Australia, I think she said. And it just kind of hit me. I went, oh, but wine is a job. That's a thing.
Wait a minute.
No. So I was like, oh, I don't know what I want to do when I grow up now.
That's awesome. So what actually made you go to Turkey?
I got transferred here for work.
Oh, okay.
For a job that was like a short-term project, but I kind of fell in love with Istanbul and never really liked D.C. all that much, so I decided to stay. And, 7 years later, don't regret it.
That's fantastic. That's fantastic. It's nice to hear a positive relocation thing, you know, like, you know, you hear lots of times that people relocate to another country or whatever, and then that job kind of dissolves and then they're stranded. So it's actually really nice to hear a positive, you know, a positive thing. What went through your mind when they said, hey, do you want to go to Turkey?
I actually was so thrilled. I had been here maybe a year previous to my move on holiday. Fell in love with the city so much that I almost called my roommate back in the States to say, sell my stuff for rent. I'm not coming home.
Wow.
I know. So I had all these plans to quit my job and move out here on my own and do I don't know what. And then suddenly a project here opened up and they needed somebody to come out here and represent it. I know, it's kind of exactly that.
Wow.
So it was really, really lucky for me.
All the stars were aligned for you. That's awesome. That's awesome. I think about how difficult it was, or how, not difficult, crazy it was for us to relocate from New Jersey to California, I can't imagine the logistics of relocating to another country. I mean,
I got lucky in that regard too, though.
Did you?
I made my parents ship all my boxes so I could pack them and move here with a suitcase and then make them ship everything later.
Wow, and you got them like a month later?
Oh, yeah.
Wow. Wow. That's awesome. That's awesome. So what exactly do you do? And do you have a professional wine job?
Well, my day job, as I like to call it, I do consulting for an events management company here. So mostly we arrange large meetings for international companies who want to come to Turkey to hold events. Has nothing to do with wine, but it pays for my wine.
There you go.
That's what's important. But then, kind of in addition to that, I don't really get paid for it. I maybe break even if I'm lucky. I give wine tastings on mostly a monthly basis, mostly to other foreigners, but also I have a number of Turks who come to my tastings who also don't know about their wine. And just trying to spread the word about Turkish wine and how good it actually is.
And I think that's so cool because you're totally sharing your passion with, you know, other people who want to learn, and that's incredible in my world, you know.
It's so much fun. It really is. I absolutely love doing it.
And now is your education self-taught? Did you take classes, combination? Because we all self-teach at some point.
It's a combination. It's mostly self-taught. I did take and managed to pass the first WSET level here. I'm hoping to skip two and go directly into three because courses one and two are only offered in Turkish here. And my Turkish got me through level one, but I really don't think it will get me through level two.
Oh.
Yeah, I do level three in English, so I'm hoping they'll let me skip the level.
Oh, wow. Wow.
But other than that, it's reading, it's listening to podcasts, and it's talking to winemakers. I've visited the vast majority of the wineries here, and I've met some phenomenal people and have learned a lot from them.
I think that, you know, I mean, I have it from a lot of different angles. You know, my undergrad and my graduate degree are in biology, microbiology, which had nothing to do with the wine world. You know, honestly, my undergrad was marine biology. So, I mean, I was supposed to be working with dolphins right now. a little far cry. But the biology and the microbiology definitely play a big role in the winemaking world. And then we did go back, and Mike, my husband, is a food scientist. So that obviously makes sense. But, you know, we both went back to school. We went to UC Davis to go through the winemaking program because we wanted to focus in on that. And every vintage, you learn something new. Like it's on the job, you know, or, you know, on the dirt training, basically, you know, every vintage, something new comes up, or, you know, you develop something different. But I did go through the, I skipped level one, WSET, and I went with level two, and I graduated, I think it was May. I just did it. I think it was May. And I was stressed over it, you know, and everybody in my class is like, oh my God, you're a winemaker. You can do this. I'm like, no, this is a whole different ball game. This is, you know, send me 50 or 100 questions on winemaking. I'm going to be all right. But, you know, Australia and, you know, sending out good vibes to Australia today, but, you know, like learning the regions and Italy, all the DOCs and all that, that's a whole different level of education.
That terrifies me. I am terrified.
Yeah. my husband asks, he's like, so are you going to do WSET3? Like, you know, you going to do it? And I'm like, not at the moment. Like, right? Because I put way, to, you know, I've got, I think I have 450 index cards from level two.
Oh my gosh, yeah.
You know?
I see other people studying for level three, and I am terrified. I'm like, oh, I'm not studying at that level. Should I be studying at that level? Oh my God, what am I doing?
Right, you know. A couple of the people who were in the class with me went on to level three, and they all passed, and they're like, oh, you could do this without it. I'm like, you have no idea what I was doing at night to, you know, get that, you know. But I'm way too competitive. Like, I can't just pass. I had to pass with distinction, you know. And if I didn't, it would have been a complete failure to me, you know. I'm like, and I'm not saying people who don't pass with distinction is failure. It's my personality.
Exactly. It's a self-motivational or self-terrorism.
Yeah. It's masochism, right? It's like, you know, it's crazy. It's crazy. All right. So you have a combination of education, and I think hands-on is again, nothing against books or whatever, but I think hands-on is really what makes it, at least for me, makes it stick in my brain more so, you know.
Yeah, same.
I can honestly say out of those 450 index cards, probably about 300 of them are out of my brain already, you know. But it is. All right, so let's get to Turkey.
Yes.
All right, so for those who, and I'm not going to lie, there was no Turkey in WSET level 2. There was
no. I imagine there was not. I don't think there's. Maybe get a paragraph in the level three book at most.
Right. So let's start off with where is it for us geographically, you know, poor people there?
No, don't be silly. No, I mean, Turkey's actually quite huge. It's just kind of stuck in the middle of a bunch of things. So I think it often gets overlooked if you're looking at a map. But it famously straddles two continents, or rather Istanbul does anyway, and borders Bulgaria and Greece to the west, and Georgia, Armenia, Iraq, Iran, and Syria to the east. And then, of course, we've got the Mediterranean, the Aegean, the Black Sea. I mean, it's right in the middle of everything. And it's huge. It covers some 300,000 square miles, I think.
Oh, wow.
Home to 80 million people. We have 20 of those are in Istanbul, I think.
Wow. Well, that's all, you know, I think that's all people ever see is Istanbul.
Is Istanbul or maybe the coast. There are quite a lot of really beautiful, like, resort beach areas here, yes, along the Aegean and the Mediterranean. So I think, yeah, you see Istanbul and you see the coast.
All right. Okay. And see, now I'm going to be really naive, or, well, I'll admit my stupidity here. There's no... completely safe Istanbul, like no issues, nothing, right? We don't have anything like the, you know, the trains that are in India, that, right? It's very modernized, right?
It is very modern, yes. It's very, very modern. And they are expanding the metro every year, for which we are ever so grateful, because it is a huge city. You could drive, I think, for 2 hours in any direction, even without standard Istanbul traffic, and still be technically in the city.
Oh.
I mean, as far as I'm concerned, it's more of a state than a city properly. Okay. It's a huge, huge area.
How many, like, airports, like, for the whole country, like...
Oh, gosh.
You've got to have multiple airports, right? Because it's massive.
There are two in Istanbul. Izmir has one, I think. Ankara has just one. Trabzon, Elazığ, Marga. I mean, no, there are airports everywhere.
It's everywhere.
It's just a huge, huge country. And there is a fast train that goes, I think, from Istanbul to Ankara. And there are a few other places where the train goes. But otherwise, it's the bus, which, no thank you. No, I won't be on a bus if it's longer than 3 hours. That's my rule. The bus or it's airplanes, because, yeah, it's a big country.
All right. So you literally fly from one part of Turkey to another part more?
Yes, okay. Absolutely. And in visiting the wineries, yeah, we fly into an airport somewhere, we pick up a rental car, and then we go from there. And sometimes it's still another hour to drive until we hit the first winery.
Wow, so that actually was going to be one of my questions. Istanbul, that's your main city, your state that you're talking about. Are there wine regions within there, or is everything outside of there?
Everything is outside, but the closest wine region, we do have some, if you just count the traffic, there are some wineries that are within an hour and a half to 2 hour drive. So you can do a day trip if you want to get up really early. I don't usually.
No. It's tough to wake up early to then go drive, to then go drink, and then to go drive back. It's tough. That makes it tough.
It is.
So what climate would you say that the wine regions typically have?
Oh, everything. Truly. And I think it's because it is such a vast country. So if you're up in like Thrace, which is kind of our nearest wine region, and that's where the border with Bulgaria and Greece is, Thrace, they all have their own. There it's very kind of cold continental. I think they have snow already. And we get snow like maybe 2 or 3 days out of the whole year in Istanbul, which I appreciate. I hate snow.
I'm with you.
But it's covered with snow up there. But then you go down to the extreme southwest of the country to the Mardin Media area, which is right on the border with Syria. And there it's no more of an arid continental, I think, but we also have Mediterranean. There's some oceanic influences. It all depends on where you are in the country. And there are small wine regions kind of spread around the whole huge landmass.
Awesome. So excluding wine, right, for one moment, what's like Turkey's like import, export, what?
Importing, I think they import a lot of cars, electronics, like personal electronics, phones, computers, that kind of thing. I know I'm missing something else, but it's a lot more industrial electronic kind of things. Export-wise, they make a lot of, household appliances. There are two really big companies here, and they export mostly to Europe. They're really big. They're big shipbuilders, which I learned while doing a little bit of research for this. They build, high-end yachts, I guess.
All right.
That was new to me. They're also one of the world's largest producers of, if not actually the largest, hazelnuts and raisins.
They are competing with my Fresno?
they are, I'm sorry. They are the sixth largest grape-producing country in the world.
Wow.
Huge chunk of that goes into raisins.
Wow. Do they have, we've got Sunkist, is that raisin made, whatever, do they have their own brand of raisin, or are they exporting that for us?
I honestly don't think it gets exported under the Turkish name. Have a feeling that they have contracts with international companies.
Wow, that's kind of cool. All right, so let's get down to some WSET stuff here. That is not in any book that you're ever going to read as of now. So let's talk about a little bit of the history of Turkish wine. When did it start? What are their main, what do they do?
that's such a huge, how much time do you have?
Right.
So Turkish wine history goes back to the Hittites. I think they have a pretty similar timeline with, Georgia and Armenia as far as having that level of history. And the Hittites were serious about their wine. Like, they laid down regulations that then carried on to the Greek and the Roman populations as they came through. But that kind of history aside, modern winemaking didn't really begin here until about the 40s. For a very brief period, sorry, rewinding a little bit, because this is a really cool little factoid, I think. For a very brief period, the Ottoman Empire was the largest wine exporter to Europe. This was when Phylloxera first came through and was devastating Europe, and they had no wine because they had no more vineyards, right? Turkey hadn't been hit yet. It did get hit eventually, but it hadn't been hit yet. The Ottoman Empire was exporting more wine to Europe during that period. It's something like six times the current annual production.
Wow.
I know, right? It's really kind of cool. But then the Turkish Republic came in, and there was the population exchange when all of the Greek Turks went back to Greece and all of the Turkish Greeks came back here. I hope I'm saying that correctly. But unfortunately, Turkey lost most of its winemaking knowledge at that period. So there was a big chunk of about 20, 30 years when wine really petered off here. And then it came back in around the 40s with two of our biggest, oldest companies, Doligia and Cavazzadetti. And then it kind of went along, for a couple few years. But it wasn't really until the 90s that really quality winemaking started here. It started with two small wineries who really spearheaded this small production quality winemaking here. And then it got another boost in the early aughts, I think, when the Turkish government was giving grants to new winemakers to put in vineyards and to keep the industry going. So now we have something like 160 registered wineries.
Okay. Less than Paso.
So it's quite large for what people think the wine industry might be, not comparatively. But I would hesitate to guess that maybe only 80, 90 of those are really quality wineries. A lot of the rest of them are bulk production that they don't really have recognizable commercial names.
And when you go into, do you have like wine shops, food shops, do you have dedicated wine shops? I'm so stupid when it comes to outside.
Why would you know? I mean, you must come obviously and check these out yourself. But no, we do. Particularly in Istanbul and Izmir and a few other cities, because, gastronomy has really started taking off here, and wine has been able to kind of pitch its star for that as well. But there are a number of dedicated bottle shops. We have a couple of really great little wine bars here in Istanbul, but we also have, we have Carrefour, so I don't know if we have Carrefour. But between them and a couple other big grocery store chains, you can also get pretty decent wine just at the local grocery store. Okay.
And the wines that are in that shop, are they, not exact, obviously, but are you getting, are you getting American wine? Are you getting French wine? Are you able to get a sample of the main wine regions?
To a degree, we actually don't have a lot of American wine. We see a little bit of Californian wine and one or two Washington State wines, but both because of the alcohol taxes and the import taxes, imported wine here is maddeningly expensive. But we do also see a lot of European wine, French mostly. Turks love Bordeaux. You could drown in the amount of Bordeaux here. But we get wine from Germany and Austria, and every once in a while you might even see a wine from Lebanon. I know, it's really kind of interesting what you can and can't get here as far as the selection.
And now a word from our sponsor. Exploring the Wine Glass is brought to you by Dracena Wines. Dracena Wines is an artisan winery located in Paso Robles, California. They have been producing wine since 2013. Their first vintage began with one wine, their classic Cabernet Franc, which received a 91 in Wine Enthusiast. Since then, they have increased production, received several accolades, including double gold medals in the San Francisco Chronicle Wine Competition, and consistent 90-plus ratings. In addition to their classic Cabernet Franc, they now produce a single vineyard, single clone reserve Cabernet Franc, and a rosé of Syrah. Although they've increased production every year, they continue to sell out each vintage. Find out more about Dracena Wines and their award-winning wines at DracenaWines.com and let them help turn your moments into great memories.
Now, see, now you can't have a conversation about wine and import and export. Now, the tariffs would have no impact on you.
No. No, we're already getting hit really hard by our own tariffs here.
So can you name a Californian wine that you can readily get?
Readily, I'm not so sure about readily. What is the maker? Oh, this is killing me. There's a California Zinfandel wine that we can get duty free, and I suddenly am just completely forgetting the name of it.
From Lodi?
It's one of, yes.
From Lodi. So Michael David?
No. No, I wish. Oh. Maybe we can get Michael David here.
I'm just trying to see, like, what would a bottle... all right, so forget the name. What would a bottle of that California Zin, if you were living here versus living there?
So let's say back when I lived in D.C. and went to Trader Joe's all the time, and my $8 to $10 bottle of wine from Trader Joe's is going to set you back at least $30 here.
Wow.
I drink a lot of Turkish wine. I mean, it's not really any cheaper depending on how far up the quality chain you go, but at least you have gone up the quality chain, and especially for me, knowing how much that bottle would have cost me in the States, sometimes I just
it's torture. Right. It's always funny when you know you can get it for a certain price. You know, like if you just walked in and you're like, oh, $30 for this. Okay. But when you know you could get it for $8 someplace else, it's a little torture.
Yeah, it is. I drink a lot when I go back to the States.
Gotta make up time.
I do. I have people pre-shop for me, and I have my bottles ready.
There you go. There you go. Well, the next time you come back, you'll have to let me know, because I have a very good friend who lives in Annapolis, right outside of D.C. So I can always crash at his place. Ryan, I'm coming to crash at your place. So I could always crash his place, and then we could have a real in-life meetup.
And that would be so brilliant. And, I absolutely love that.
He would be more than happy to drink wine with us, I'm sure.
Okay. Fantastic.
I'm sure. All right. So do you have, of this wine regions that you have, I'm assuming there's some bigger players and some smaller ones. Are the bigger ones more bulk, or can you get quality with the bigger ones?
You can absolutely get quality with the bigger ones, yes. So the bigger ones simply, that's the wrong word, sorry. They just hit all of the price points.
Okay.
So we have the wineries that offer everything from, we have this term here in Turkey. In Turkish, it's köpek öldüren, which literally means dog killer. So there are some of the bigger, I know. There are some of the bigger wineries here who offer everything from that level to super premium.
Okay.
hitting all the price points. So.
Okay. And then those.
And we have a lot of small producers now as well, which is really brilliant.
Okay. And how easy is it for you to go, like, if you wanted to go wine tasting, do these people have tasting rooms that are open to the public? Do you have to schedule appointments?
It depends a lot on where you go. Wine tourism is a really missed opportunity right now in Turkey.
Okay.
A lot of the wineries are trying to change that. A lot of them are doing their best to change it, and quite a few areas have formed partnerships amongst the wineries themselves. They've developed their own wine routes to help encourage this, and they've built hotels attached to their wineries and restaurants because quite often there's nothing else around them. But for the most part, yes, you do still need to make appointments, either because in some cases they are just that popular, or because they're so small and out of the way, they don't necessarily actually have the facilities, but they are always happy to welcome people. Turkish hospitality is such an amazing thing. And then when you combine that with wine people, and I don't care where they're from, I think wine people are just some of the most hospitable and welcoming people ever.
Well, it might have to do that we always have alcohol in our system.
So that probably doesn't hurt. But I mean, especially when you're here, and here's a foreigner, they are just so, I think, partially flabbergasted and just so heartwarmed that you as a foreigner are interested in their wine and in their weird little grapes. They're godforsaken grapes.
See? So yeah, it was actually a perfect preface to this conversation, the godforsaken grapes. And I was so happy to see you be part of it.
I was so thrilled to take part. It's so hard for me to source wine that's appropriate for the wine pairing weekend's activity. And I saw this and I went,
wait a second.
That's my thing. Yes,
this is my whole country. Wait a second.
Yes, it is.
And I had to actually really, really laugh at the umlauts, because it is. You put the umlauts in there and Americans run away, man. I've said that with several of the, you know, other regions that I've tasted through. You know, same thing with Greece. It's like, these wines are incredible. Your cat?
They are. Yes, yes. Running back and forth.
You know, Greece has some amazing wines, but you need a translation book with you in order to know what you're drinking. And I think Americans are terrified of that. And
I get it.
When I first got into wine, I would definitely pick something I recognized over something I had never heard. Now I'm like, nope, no, that one. Ooh, what's this? You know, now I'm going after the ones that I've never heard of before, you know?
Oh, absolutely. And I mean, speaking of Greece, not that I want to plug another country over my own adopted country, but I went last year to their big, huge wine festival, Onorama, which is like the first weekend in March. And we made a beeline for, they had a special section for essentially unheard of grapes.
Oh, okay.
And we just went straight there. And it was like, tell us about these things that we have no idea what they are.
Right?
Yeah,
see?
It's brilliant.
The wine geeks unite, man. That's where we want to be. That's where we want to be.
Absolutely. And unfortunately for Turkey, they have both umlauts and they have that little hat over the G.
G?
Yes. And then they have the, I actually don't know what the term for it is, the little thing under the C.
See? Yeah, I don't know what that's called either. I don't know what that's called either. But I think that's a little less intimidating. I think people just see the C, The umlaut and the G, the whatever that thing is, that's a little more, nerve-wracking there. So with that being said, before we actually get into these godforsaken grapes of Turkey, do you have indigenous grapes there? Do you have the international, not, sure. I'm sorry, not indigenous, the international grapes there?
Oh, yes, yes, yes. They are, I'm sorry to say, more popular than the indigenous grapes. I think, I mean, if I could hazard a guess, I think it would be because when the wine industry really kind of came back here, people were traveling to Europe, especially France, and they were learning about wine there, and they came back, and so they started, we didn't have wine here at the time, right? So they were emulating what they had learned. Right. So Syrah is actually, I think, the third most widely planted grape here, and the first most popular of all of the grapes. It goes Sultania, Akuzuzub, and Syrah.
Oh.
But Syrah, Cab, Merlot, Cab Franc, lots and lots of Chardonnay. We even have one producer up in France who is planting, I think, just kind of every grape that he can think of. He just loves to experiment, God bless him. So he's got, in addition to a bunch of indigenous grapes, he has Riesling and Albarino, and he's even planting some Greek grapes now, and Mavrud, which is Bulgarian, and I mean, he's doing everything.
Wow. See, that's cool because, you know, like 10 years down the road, he's going to be like dominant because he's going to really learn which grapes really can grow in that environment, and then everybody's going to be behind the eight ball trying to catch up with him. See, he's smart.
Exactly. Yeah.
He's smart. He's smart. All right, so let's get to these umlauts and the things with the G and all of that stuff. So let's go over a few of your most common indigenous grapes and tell me what can we expect, you know, if we ever can get our hands on these in our glass.
Okay. So I think, well, I already mentioned that the first or the most widely planted black grape variety here is called the Akuzuzub. It's also one of the harder ones to say. It's got four umlauts in it. Yeah, that's a challenge. It means bull's eye.
Oh, okay.
Because the grape itself is quite large, round, and very, very black in color. So it looks like a bull's eye. It's kind of, if I would compare it to an international grape, it's kind of like our Merlot.
Okay.
It's got a little bit more lushness and roundness on the palate. Very fruit forward, but also tastes very well to oak. And then is kind of a natural blending partner with a grape called Boazke, which means throat burner. Because this is sometimes they have really great names for these grapes. It's called throat burner because it is so tannic. It is so highly tannic.
Wow.
That if it's made clumsily, it will. It will just, yeah. It'll not do nice things to you. If made well, it can be really beautiful and have a lot of structure, it's our cap.
Okay.
And then the third most common black grape is the one that I'm drinking, the Kalajic Kadasa. And this is kind of like our Pinot. It's very flexible. We have everything from white to, lots of Mont Noir, because I, rosé. It's a very nice grape for rosé, especially if you like it. We don't have a lot of sweet rosé, thank God. not bad, sorry. They're usually quite dry. But Kalajic Kadasa, one of the most common aroma notes from it is cotton candy. So it really lends itself well as like a nice summery rosé. But it can make some very serious red wines and is, in fact, one of the more ageable red wines made here.
Wow.
Then we have for whites, Nottingen, which is kind of our Chardonnay.
Okay.
It does both very well in showing terroir. It's grown across the country now, and it's very different depending on where it's grown, but it's also very malleable and can take a lot of oak in the way that Chardonnay often can.
Does it become buttery? Do they do buttery?
It does. Yeah. Absolutely. Buttery and nutty and butterscotchy and all of those things. And then I think Emirsch is our other really big.
Okay, we can pronounce that one.
It is. It's a little easier. It's a little more common of a word. And this is from the Cappadocia region, the region that you we have the fairy chimneys and cave churches, and you see pictures of Turkey with like hot air balloons. That's all Cappadocia, and that's, I'm not sure I can give a good comparison for that. It's a little bit Albarino, it's a little bit Sauvignon Blanc, it's a little bit of a lot of things, but it often gets described as being slightly salty.
Oh.
Because of the minerality in it. And it's,
oh, I bet I would love that.
Oh, it's such a brilliant grape. It really is. But it does not do well with oak at all. So it's never oaked. But it does often get blended. Apparently, it's a very difficult grape to grow.
Oh, okay. Salinity in a wine is my kryptonite, man. I just will bow down to it in there, you know.
Absolutely.
The first time I had an Albarino from Rhea Spicius, I was all right, sign me up. This is it. I'm in love, and you know.
Yeah, I think you would really like our Amir then.
And it's, but you know, I'll go everywhere and I will try the Albarino, and they just can't. They can't get it like Rhea Spicius can. They, you know, it's very unique, and you know, I get all excited. Yay, Albarino! Oh, you know, and it's good wine, but I'm like, oh,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah, it's not got that edge. Yeah,
right.
Absolutely.
Right, and that's actually very similar to the Albarino. Has that same salinity. And neither of them, well, some are going into oak, but you know, they're mostly steel, stainless steel. So now, can we get any of those here in the United States?
You can. In fact, that's why I mentioned those specifically, because if you can find them, those are going to be the grapes that you can find. The Amir, I know specifically, the Tourisan company, which is one of our larger companies, it has a long, long history in Cappadocia. I know that they're in the U.S.
Okay.
Collegiate Carasa, I know you can get. In fact, the sparkling wine that I'm drinking tonight, I know you can get. Couscous de Bois here. You should be able to find some of these. A lot of them are, let me think. They're kind of, it's coastal. Kind of where you can get the Turkish wines. So it seems to either be like California or Washington State or... New York, Connecticut, interestingly, there's a retail there.
Wow, Connecticut, that's a tough one.
Places in the D.C. area. I know, right? Connecticut, that wouldn't surprise me.
Yeah.
And I think they ship pretty widely to the retailer in Connecticut.
Okay. You've got to send me a message of the actual one you're really drinking.
I will.
Because, you know, can I savor it? If I can saber it, I'm all over it.
I have never tried to saber a wine, so I don't know about this one for ability.
It's a true sparkling, though, right? Is it a true sparkling?
It is a true sparkling. In fact, the owner of this particular winery, when she opened her winery, her number one goal was to make the first traditional method sparkling wine with a native grape, and she did it. She was the first, and so a bunch of people have followed. We now have a really wide range of sparkling wines here, made everything from, you know, just adding CO2. We have tank method, and we have a lot of traditional method wines, but made out of Turkish grapes, and it's really exciting.
That's awesome. She's my hero. That's awesome. All right, so if you had to pick your favorite child, which is always the most horrible question. See, it's easy for me. Like, everybody knows it's Cab Franc. It's a piece of cake. Nobody even asks me that question. But if you had to pick a favorite child, what would it be?
You know, I thought about this, and it's such a hard question to answer, not just because I really do love a lot of the grapes, but we're still really learning what a lot of these grapes can do, and I think a lot of that comes from the fact that Turkey has no appellation system, we have no viticulture arrows, there's nothing like that here. So winemakers are experimenting with grapes across the country. So this Amir that's from Cappadocia with its volcanic limestone, you know, tooth soils, tastes so different there than it does on the Rene Plateau in Izmir, which is more of a Mediterranean, like, what's the word, like really environment, or like really mineral-rich soils and everything. So we still don't really know
what grows where.
We can't really pin down yet exactly what a lot of the personalities of these grapes are, so it's so hard to answer that.
It's like the wild west of grape growing.
It really is. I mean, in our Orla region, which is, Orla is part of the Izmir, the Aegean region, they have one of the most well put together wine routes, very easy to follow. They have everything from Boazkere and Nadinja and Cabernet to Echigaina. That was a new grape for me. What else is down there? Sangiovese, Tanat, Marcellin.
Wow.
I'm with everything. So it's very experimental here. It's really kind of cool.
Well, I think that's kind of the way a lot of wine regions get their start, right? They just, you don't know what your region is good at. So you're basically, you know, taking your odds, you know, favoring your odds and saying, if I plant all of these, you know, and I start to play with them, I can always rip these up and plant what really works. So I think they're following in the pattern of most well-established wine regions. This is what they do. I know Arizona, there's a couple of wineries I know in Arizona that are doing exactly the same thing. They're producing, you know, I interviewed somebody and they're producing like 20 different wines. And I'm like, oh my God.
Oh my God.
She's like, well, we don't really know what goes well yet. So we kind of make it and then it goes in the tasting room and we hear what people like and then we either pull it out or we, you know, bulk up the production.
Yeah.
So they're following, I think, in the basic premise footsteps of, you know, we all can't be Bordeaux that have had, you know, all of these, you know, generations of growing.
Do the work for us and tell us what works here and what doesn't.
Right. Who, by the way, are changing now what their rules are, right? So
they are adding new grapes, right?
Right. Yeah. So times change and you've got to adapt or whatever. So I get that. I get that. It's so different in different areas that it's a little tough. Now, do you buy most of your wines at the wineries, or are you going to your wine shop and buying out the store?
It's a combination. It's a combination. Because I've kind of set myself a mission that I want to try all of the Turkish wines before whatever nebulous date it might be that I leave the country. So I try not to buy the same wine more than once, unless I just completely fall in love with it. So it's a combination. If I'm at a winery, I'll buy wine when I'm there, but I'm also always at the bottle shop. I walk in, and they know me so well now, they immediately tell me, oh, this is new. And I'm like, oh, okay. Let me have that then.
You're the norm of Turkish wine.
I am.
That's awesome. That is awesome. All right. So earlier I mentioned that those amazing videos that you make and the tasting cards. So tell me, I love them. I absolutely love them.
Thank you.
And,
thank you.
You know, it's like I see it starting, and I know it's you. So it's brand, you know, it's brand spot on, but it's so good. So how did you develop these, and are you doing these yourselves? Are the wineries helping you promote this? What's going on?
Well, so when I got started with these, I mean, these wine infographics are so popular now, and I think really kind of started by Wine Folly, and I love them so much. And then their new book came out, and they've incorporated like some new grapes, like some of the Greek varieties, but there were still no Turkish varieties. And I was like, we got to make these. Nobody else is doing this. We got to do this. So I partnered with a project partner of mine already, called my co-author, and we found a phenomenal local graphic designer, Empathia Creative, and between the three of us, we came up with first the tasting cards, and a lot of it, in some cases, was just us sitting down, tasting wines, going, all right, we think that it tastes like this. I mean, full disclosure.
Right. Well.
Coming to a consensus. I mean, some of these grapes, like the ones we mentioned before, Crispy Zubalas, Kerry, there are some standardized aromas and flavors that are supposed to be in these, but there are similar unusual grapes that maybe only one or two producers make and we know very little about.
Right.
And extracting information from some of the wineries here is a lot like extracting tea. So we did some of this research on our own. Research. And that's how we came up with the tasting cards. But then the videos, that was the sole genius of Empathia Creative, of our graphic designer. She just presented us with this as an idea, and we fell in love with it. And so she took the images that she used on the tasting cards and, yeah, made these little gifts out of them. And, yeah, we're just so thrilled with them. We're so pleased.
Now, what's your plan? Like, are you creating a tasting notes box or something that like you can sell, or, you know, where do you see that going? Because they're awesome. They really are.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Well, I mentioned a couple times that I have a partner. She writes under the name Istan Lights. Her blog is about Beyond the Kebab, Turkish food. She's a food historian, and herself a phenomenal patisserie bread baker. And we are co-authoring a book about Turkish wines.
Beautiful.
Which will be, if we get a publisher, it will be the first book written in about 15 years about Turkish wines.
Wow.
Yeah. And so we want to put the tasting cards, a big section of the book is going to be about the indigenous grapes, and we want to include these as graphics with those. We want to try to, you know, get people interested in Turkish wines. I think if we can help make the demand abroad, get people interested in it, and if they start asking their bottle shops, then it will help, you know, get more wines.
Great. Right. If people ask, the wine shops will find a way to deliver. And
I hope so.
And I mean, it might actually be a really good time to start doing that, because they're focusing in on. You know,
yeah,
they're going to be looking.
As horrible as that is, and I'm still worried about the effect that those are going to have on the industry at
right.
large. But maybe they'll be good for us over here.
Yeah. It will, you know, I mean, they're going to have to, if it goes through for however long of a period it's going to be, they're going to need something to replace it with, you know, so,
yeah.
You know, when one door closes, you know, the window opens for somebody else, you know.
Hopefully that one will move on to Turkey.
All right. So we joke about the umlauts and that stuff, but what do you really think is the biggest reason there's just that much of a difficulty of the Turkish wines coming here to the U.S.?
I think it's twofold. One, I mean, I joke, but I do kind of want to name the book, Yes, They Make Wine in Turkey. So few people know that Turkey makes wine. So I think it just never even enters somebody's mind that they could ask for Turkish wine. But on top of that, for the producers here, you know, we have, you know, maybe 5-6 really big producers. And these are the ones that you'll find in the U.S. and in Europe. But so many of the producers are smaller producers, and so their stock is limited, which means that they by themselves can't really make up a full palette to export somewhere. And there's some small cooperation issues among some of the wineries. So getting them kind of together to, you know, make up a palette for somebody, I think you need, you know, an exporter who is really dedicated to Turkish wine to come over and be like, all right, look, I know you can't make, I'm just going to make up the palate myself, but I'm going to take your wine, I'm going to take your wine.
Right.
And then I'm going to go back to promote the crap out of this. So if we have some of the supply, but we need to make the demand. And then,
Well, if that day ever comes that you come back to the United States, I think I see your new job when you come back to the United States.
I actually would love to open my own wine bar if I go back to the States, and focus on what I lesser appreciated wine countries and wine regions. I mean, I'm very lucky living in Istanbul for any number of reasons, but with the kind of hop over into the next country and explore somebody else's wines for a little while and come back, and huge amount of Turkish wines on my wine list.
If somebody is going to actually like travel to Turkey, what are like non-wine things that you would say, all right, you know, first of all, how long of a flight is it from like the East Coast?
Well, if you get a direct flight, I think it's 8 hours.
Okay, so very doable.
Istanbul. I mean, you don't really even have to leave Istanbul if you don't want to. There's so much here, especially for history buffs. We have the area of the city Sultanahmet, where right in this one small area, we have the Hagia Sophia, which is one of the oldest Christian churches. It's huge. Apparently, off of her pedestal, the Statue of Liberty will fit under the main dome. This place is enormous.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. And I mean, this is like, we're talking like back in Constantine's era. This church is so old.
Wow.
So we have that. We have the very famous Blue Mosque, which is beautiful. The Topkapı Palace, which is a proper Ottoman style palace. It's so stunning. There's an archaeology museum. There are Byzantine churches that, yes, go back centuries. There are, I mean, throw a rock and you hit a mosque, and some of these are just stunningly beautiful places. Palaces. We have palaces all up and down the Bosphorus. You can take a Bosphorus tour. We have dolphins. Very exciting when I spot dolphins. And if you go outside of the city, the easiest day trip for me is you fly into Izmir, get a little bus, and you go to an area called Selçuk, where in a day, you can do all this in a day, and I've done it like 8 times, so I know this is true. You go to a place called Meryemana, which is the last house of Mary, where Mary lived with St. John. To the ruins of the city of Ephesus, which are some of the best preserved Greco-Roman ruins in the Aegean.
Wow.
The Ephesus Museum is stunning. There are ruins for, I think it's the Basilica of St. John, where supposedly his, like, he's entombed there.
Oh, wow.
I know. And there are ruins nearby. We have Pamukkale, which is about a 3-hour drive from there. These are the limestone travertines.
Oh.
It's just Google this place. The pictures are stunning. But this is a this country is a historian's dream.
And what about, like, food? What's your main dish? Because that's always my problem.
It's a big meat country.
Yeah.
If you like meat, this is a good place for you. Barbecue is a huge thing here. So okay. They have the kebab, the dinner, the big
thing, like get a Greek. Yeah.
But their menus here are also incredible and varied, and have the English, like the grape leaf.
Okay. So very Greek type, Mediterranean food.
Mediterranean is a more politic.
Politically correct way to say it.
Yeah. But also there's a lot of fish, so if you're not a meat eater, fish is so widely available here, particularly, again, I'm losing the English, anchovies. They love anchovies. It's a really wide food menu, and honestly, the farther east in the country you go, the better the food gets.
Okay. All right. So there's a nice little tip for travelers. Okay. All right. So my last question is, going back to the wineries, if somebody was coming now to visit the wineries, are they planning like a day in this wine region and a day in this wine region? Or can they really just travel about? I mean,
I think a lot of it depends on how much time you have.
Okay.
Since you do have to fly to a number of the places, my suggestion would be to pick a region.
Okay.
And then do a couple wineries there, but also hit some of these historical tourist sites. And you can combine a lot of them. Like, for example, we have a lot of wineries on the Gallipoli Peninsula. So particularly every Australian I have ever met, you don't come to Turkey and not go to the Gallipoli Peninsula to Çanakkale and, you know, see the war memorials there. But then across the water from that is Troy.
Oh.
And so you can go enjoy that kind of Hellenistic history and some of the nice beaches and hit a few wineries.
All right. Sounds like a perfect vacation. Vacation.
Yeah.
And, yeah, I mean, earlier you mentioned how there's snow in the upper north region or whatever. Is there a better time? Like, what is your peak tourist time versus when might people be able to get better deals type during the year?
I think peak tourist time is kind of May through September.
Okay.
But at least here in Istanbul and in the south and the east of the country, we have pretty warm and temperate weather through November, early December sometimes. And you can also come as early as March or April. It might rain a little bit, but your prices are definitely going to be cheaper, and some of these attractions are going to be far less crowded during those periods. Yeah.
Awesome. So, as you know, since you listen, I always end these interviews with my little Phoebe game of opposites. I'm just going to say two words, and whichever one, you know, resonates with you first, I guess, we'll do that. We're going to start off with some non-wine terms, and then we will move on to onto the wine terms. Okay?
Okay.
All right, here we go. Night or day?
Nice.
Sunset or sunrise?
Ooh, sunrise.
Black or white?
Black.
Walk or run?
Oh, walk. I don't run.
I don't run anywhere. food or drink?
Drink.
Old world, new world?
Old world.
Sweet or dry?
Oh, both? Can I both?
Sure. Okay. Absolutely. Bubbles or still?
Bubbles, since that's what I'm drinking right now.
Okay. Oak or stainless?
Stainless.
Drink now or drink later?
Drink now.
Blend or varietal?
Varietal.
Vintage or non-vintage?
I would like to say vintage, but I can't really afford it usually.
That's a good answer. Okay. Cork or screw cap?
Cork.
Commercial or indigenous?
Indigenous.
Bordeaux or Rhone?
Rhone.
Warm climate or cool climate?
Cool climate.
And Napa or Sonoma? Turkey.
Sonoma. I got rid of, like, when was the last time I had a wine from either of those places?
Thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me and to share all your knowledge of Turkey and Turkish wines. And, you know, I really...
Such a pleasure and an honor, really. This was such a highlight, and it's starting my year this way. This is so brilliant.
Oh, and I just, really, it's so awesome to like, see you face to face and to talk to you so that other people can find you and see these awesome gifts that you do and the things, the tasting cards and all that. Where can people find you on the social medias?
So you can find me, I have a website, thecorkycork.com. You can also find me on Instagram under quirkycork or on Twitter at lemieux.andrea.
Thank you for joining me. I will see everybody on the socials, and thanks for listening to Allure of the Poor. Sláinte.
Thank you, Lori.
This has been another episode of Exploring the Wine Glass. Thanks for listening. If you have suggestions on what topics you would like me to discuss, please reach out on social media. You can find me on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook as Exploring the Wine Glass. I'm also on LinkedIn as Lori Hoyt Budd. Of course, you can always email me at exploringthewineglass@gmail.com. If you enjoyed our podcast, please rate, review, and subscribe on your favorite podcast catcher to help others find me more easily. Until next week, sláinte.